Chef, for inviting me here. It's nice, it's my first time. And I will be discussing some aspects of transport that are maybe a little bit unknown. And I will discuss later what I mean by that. And I have to acknowledge my collaborators from UCSD and also one from University of Missouri, Giovanni Vignale. My first student, Mike Zvolak, and then Neil Bouchon, and other postdocs like Duby, Pershing, and Chuchen that work with me, and D'Agosta as well. And most of the things that I will be talking about are in this book, so I do a little bit of advertisement. If you're interested, this is a book that published 2008 in Cambridge University Press on transport in electronics in nanoscale systems. So let me start with an outline. And I will introduce the problem of transport. And then I will actually discuss many-body effects in transport. In particular, I will show you an analogy with the classical liquid, and so the possibility to detect turbulence. In fact, many of the things that I will be discussing are predictions, theoretical predictions that can be verified in both condensed matter and atomic physics. And then other predictions that we'll be discussing are related to transport in atomic gases. And I will talk about a totally different way of looking at the transport problem using what we call the microcanonical picture of transport. And we'll explain what it is. So let me start with the introduction of the problem. It's apparently very simple, right? So you essentially have a wire, and you have a battery. You switch on the battery, and you have electrons that flow. So the engineers know how to write this in these symbols. And what we're looking for is the conductance or the inverse, which is the resistance. So it's apparently a very simple problem. And the question is whether this has been solved. And I would actually argue that it has a lot of surprises, especially at the atomic level, so at the nanoscale level. And so I'll try to actually discuss some of these surprises later. So why is it difficult actually to discuss and theoretically this problem, and why it is interesting? Well, the first thing is that the system is out of equilibrium. So the electrons and the underlying lattice, so the ions, are out of equilibrium. So you have that the non-equilibrium statistical mechanics is still an open subject, and so we are in a field that is still open. And then you have interactions among electrons. And in condensed matter physics, for example, it's difficult to switch them off. However, I will show you later that in atomic physics, you can switch off the interactions. And so you can study truly non-interacting systems. And there are interesting phenomena there, too. In condensed matter, in particular, you have also interaction between electrons and ions that you cannot avoid. This leads to current-induced forces, heating, and all sorts of phenomena that are known to exist. You have interaction with an environment as well, and I don't need to discuss much about this in this institute. And as last, the physical properties are quite sensitive, especially at the atomic level. So a single atom difference, when you have very few atoms in the system, makes a huge difference compared to a bulk-like situation. So let me then try to go through, starting from the experiments, how we actually try to simulate these things, or at least understand it theoretically. So you start from the real system, right? You go to the lab, and you will have a battery attached to your system. And the first thing you want to do is forget about the battery, right? It's too complicated. There are chemical processes in there, and it's a complicated object. You don't want to treat it. So the first approximation is to transform this problem into an open quantum system problem. And so you have reservoirs that inject or absorb electrons at certain electrochemical potentials. So this is the first approximation that is generally done. Then, this can be done actually very formally. You write the Hamiltonian as the Hamiltonian of your system, the Hamiltonian of the battery, and the interaction between the two, and then you trace out the degrees of freedom of the battery, if you could do that, right? Now, if you are in a situation like this, then the question is what comes out, what is the equation of motion for the reduced density matrix of the system of interest. Now, as you know, you don't have in general a closed equation of motion for this, but under specific conditions, you could in principle do it, right? Suppose that the battery has a dense spectrum and there are no initial correlations between the battery degrees of freedom and your system. There are small interactions between the battery degrees of freedom and your system, and then you end up with an equation of this type, right? This is the usual way you would do it. Now, even if I'm doing this, I'm still not clear whether the system has or not a steady state, right? So whether the system, the original system that I started with has a steady state or not is an open question. Now, what we generally do is we assume that there is at least one steady state solution, okay? One steady state solution, and in fact, that is already not an obvious assumption. So we assume that the average current, so the average of the current operator, is a constant, okay? So that is what we assume. That doesn't mean that we are neglecting fluctuations, but it means that we can define such a thing as an average current. Okay, however, it's still a complicated problem because this is still an open many-body quantum problem, right? So how do we proceed? So one way to proceed is completely forget about the open boundary conditions and say, okay, instead of using open boundary conditions, by open I mean interaction with an environment, I assume certain boundary conditions that I call scattering boundary conditions. So I have a closed system, again, but the boundary conditions I put here are scattering-like. Okay, so I'm looking at that type of problem. Now, when you look at this, however, I have lost information. And where is this loss of information? Remember that I started with the experimental system, a closed system with the battery, right? All of it with the battery. And then I went into an open system, and then I went back to a closed system, an infinite, because I'm using scattering boundary conditions, which is in principle different, right? So in fact, going from the closed system to the open system, I could in principle determine the amount of information I lost during this process, but going from the open system I had before to this new closed system is not easy to determine. So the loss of information that I have from here to here is not easy to determine, okay? So, yes?
So when you said go back to a closed system, you mean that you are again a unitary evolution?
That's correct. In principle, I have a unitary evolution. The only thing that I have is that I have boundary conditions that are scattering-like boundary conditions. But I solve the Schrödinger equation, and right? And not an open quantum system problem. So, but in going from this open system to this one, again, unitary right evolution, I have lost information. In fact, I did an assumption. Whether this assumption is reasonable or not is an open question. Okay, well, is that enough? Even if I do that assumption, I still have interactions, right? And so if I actually have interactions everywhere in the what I call the sample, the region that I'm interested in, and what I call leads, so the regions where the electrons come in and out, well, if I have interactions everywhere, there is no closed equation of motion for the current, right? You would have in a hierarchy of equations, so the BBGKY hierarchy, and I could not solve it exactly. However, if you do have non-interacting electrons or interacting electrons at the mean field level, in the region of the leads and interactions or not in the sample, then you can close this set of equations. Now, the question you may have is where does this interface stop, right? So where is the non-interacting versus the interactive region? Where is the separation? Well, this is not clear, right? We can assume reasonably that the leads are bulk-like objects. They screen everything, and so I can assume that the electrons here and here will be interacting at a mean field level, but that's an assumption. And in fact, I don't know where to set this interface, but assume that you can do it. So now I have another approximation where I made a mean field approximation of the leads, but the sample can or cannot be interacting. Now, in this case, if I do this, then I have a problem where I have electrons on the left that are distributed according to a Fermi-Dirac distribution, and electrons on the right distributed with another Fermi Dirac distribution. I'm assuming that even despite the presence of a current, I can define a local equilibrium distributions. That's another open question, right? Whether you can do that or not. But assuming that that is true, then I have two distribution functions, and they're located at different chemical electrochemical potentials. Now, if I assume non-interacting junctions, so a non-interacting system, then I can prove that the current is of this form. From scattering theory, it has this simple form. Either I write it in terms of the transmission coefficient multiplied by the difference between the Fermi distributions, or I write it in terms of the trace of gamma R, gamma left, are the couplings between the left region and the central region and vice versa, and the retarding advanced Green's functions. Either way, they're the same thing. So this is the famous Landauer formula that is used a lot in mesoscopic and nanoscopic systems, but you see how many approximations I had to do. So I had to assume that there is such a thing as a steady state. I had to assume such a thing as this closed system, and with the boundary conditions that I set to be scattering, and then a single particle picture, I could write down a closed equation for the current. Yes, sure.
So if you make the measurement under steady state conditions,
right. So I will discuss this also later. So it is true that if I force the system into a steady state, I will have an average current that is flat, right? So the question is, what is that flat current, and how many microscopic states can realize that particular current? And what is really responsible for that steady state? Is it the battery or the junction itself, or both, right? So there are questions on top of it that this approach does not answer, right? That approach assumes the existence of a steady state, which you do see, right, experimentally, but it doesn't tell you anything on how it is generated, what really makes it, and what are the microscopic states that generate that steady state.
Well, that's a separate problem. Just like when we do thermodynamics, we don't worry about how we reach equilibrium. We assume it's an equilibrium, and then we have a formula.
That's correct. So my question is okay, I reached, under those conditions, I reached that expression. Can I answer also what actually determines that steady state, and what are the microscopic features that determine that steady state, and how different it is from this particular current that I computed from this simplified thing? That is what I'm trying to answer. Okay, so if I have, however, interactions in the sample, then the equation for you can use a non-equilibrium Green's function formalism, which is essentially many-body perturbation theory, and what you would get is actually a current that is much more complicated. You see that it's no longer a function of the difference of the Fermi Dirac distributions, but you would have also, you know, the lesser Green's functions and all these extra terms. So you have a complicated expression. So there is something more to that expression that is used in literature to describe mesoscopic systems, and it's already visible in this formula. Okay, let me then look at these. So what are these extra terms, okay? What is the physical origin of these extra terms, and what can we actually predict on this? So what are the many-body effects related to this current? Now, in order to do this, I want to change completely point of view and go back from the original problem. So in the experiments, you would have the battery, right? And if you look at it actually from a microscopic point of view, you will see that as soon as you switch on the battery, electrons accumulate on one side and deplete on the other side. In fact, if you take off the battery, what you will see is a decay of the current, like in a capacitor, right? So it's like the battery is doing what? It's simply charging the surfaces of the electrodes and then discharge like a capacitor. But it does this in a continuous fashion. So I change completely the point of view, and instead of working with this type of problem, I say, okay, my problem is like a capacitor okay? And in between, I put my system, whatever that is, and I look at the discharge of this capacitor. And in fact, if I look at, if I make the capacitor plates larger and larger, the discharge will take longer and longer, right? So this is now a close quantum system of well-defined number of electrons and well-defined number of atoms. For those of you who know density functional theory, it has an extra advantage. And the advantage is that you can prove analytically that the many-body, exact many-body current is given exactly by the Kohn-Sham single particle current. And the reason for this is precisely because this is a closed system, and I can integrate the current, right, across the, any given surface. And in density functional theory, I know that the total density is exact, and so the divergence also is exact. So I can actually go from the exact many-body current to the Kohn-Sham current exactly, okay? This is a formal result, clearly, because this is true if I knew the exact exchange correlation functional, which we don't. But if I knew the exact correlation exchange correlation functional, then I would have the exact many-body current given to you by a single particle picture. Okay, so I do this, and I look at now a case. I want to understand this this many-body effects. And by the way, if I change completely the picture and I look at the transport problem from a closed point of view like this, I don't need to do anything, right? I don't need to assume non-interacting electrodes or anything. Interactions are all over the place. This is what we call microcanonical picture of transport. So let me actually show you simulations, and I will come back to this later. And the first thing you can do here is actually consider non-interacting systems. Consider 1D or a 3D non-interacting systems, okay? And use the many the approach that I discussed before, the microcanonical picture. So you charge more on one side than the other, which means to simply put a bias and let go. What you will see is that there is a very fast relaxation mechanism. Then there is essentially a flat current, okay? And then clearly, when the electrons reach the end and come back, you will see a revival, right, type of behavior. And you would, if you would wait Poincaré time, you would also return, right? But that is very, very large. So there is a very fast time scale I want you to look at, and essentially a flat type of a steady current. So I want to investigate, and this is what we call a quasi-steady state. And as you can see here, I can make this current as go forever as long as I increase the electrons, right? I can make them longer and longer, and clearly this go will go forever. So I would imagine in the thermodynamic limit, this would be my steady state current. By the way, this is without interactions. So it means that even without interactions, the system does reach a steady state current. Now, before I go into that and also to see whether we can confirm that experimentally, let me focus on the transient. Actually, the transient time is interesting because it's in nanoscale systems, it's very fast. You can estimate it by using Heisenberg uncertainty principle, and you see that these transients occur at timescales on the order of femtoseconds or less. So remember this number because it's important later for what I will discuss. So there is a fast relaxation mechanism that leads to later to what I would call a quasi-steady state. By the way, you can compare that steady state current, if I look at this current and I compare it with the Landauer approach, and I can do it because this is a non-interacting system, for various transmissions, and you can see they're on top of each other. So essentially the analytical result that you would get from, which is the straight line, and these steady-state currents are essentially the same. So the steady-state current you get from the microcanonical picture in the non-interacting case is essentially the Landauer current. And you have the added benefit that you can see also the dynamics, so when the steady-state is formed, then you can look at the microscopic states that reach, that determine that particular steady-state. Not only that, but you can actually look at the entanglement entropy, and you may have seen the results by Levitov and Klisch, where they have estimated the entanglement rate, right? And as a function of the transmission, this is assuming a binomial distribution. And here we can actually do the exact calculation, and the binomial result would be this, and the dots are the squares that you see here. Now, the other ones are for a Gaussian distribution, and clearly you can see that the Gaussian distribution would not be a good approximation. So even a binomial approximation, which means that I send an electron in towards a nanostructure, it's either reflected or transmitted, is a reasonable approximation for this type of problem. So we have reproduced reasonably well the standard results you would expect from the Landauer formula, which is in fact coming from, which gives this result. The other thing that is interesting is that, however, I can project on the left and on the right of the two electrodes. And remember that we had this assumption that we needed Fermi-Dirac distributions. In fact, that enters into the Landauer formula. And in fact, at the initial time, that's what you would get, because that's how you prepare the system, right? Well, what comes out is that even if let the system evolve and there is a steady state current, this is again non-interacting systems, well, look at the distributions. The distributions on the left and on the right actually change a lot, and they actually reverse. So you can actually have reverse distributions while keeping the current constant. So the existence of a steady state is completely unrelated to the existence or not of Fermi distributions. You can have a steady state current even if the leads have an evolving distribution of electrons. This is another point that we cannot address with the Landauer approach. Okay, so let me then go back to this initial time, and let me show you some simulations, because this is what will lead us to turbulence, in fact, of the electron liquid. Now, I take my microcanonical picture of transport, and I do I look at a quasi-2D electron liquid. I create a bias and let go, and then I look at the current density, okay? I do this using time-dependent density functional theory, which is the time-dependent version of density functional theory, but that is not very important. It's essentially solving the Schrödinger equation with certain approximations. The thing that I want you to look at is actually this. At the initial time, you see that the electrons actually try to go towards the surfaces. They don't try to go straight. So what they try to do is to passivate the surfaces of these electrons, because remember, you have a plus and minus, and so what they try to do is literally passivate the surfaces. Once the transient is gone, then you will form a narrow directionality of flow. But if you look at this much more broader, it looks like the flow of a liquid, right? So it's like a pipe, right? A liquid that goes through a pipe. After a transient, it will actually flow across the pipe. So is there an analogy with the electron liquid? Well, the analogy is exact, in fact, which is, it goes back to, after 6 months, Schrödinger published his famous equation, Madelung showed that for a single particle, you can write the single particle Schrödinger equation in hydrodynamic form in terms of the density and the current density, right? Velocity field, which is the ratio between the current density and the density. This was 6 months later. Then this theory went away because, the Schrödinger equation took over, also because of the statistical interpretation of the wave function, which was very appealing to the experimentalists. And the deterministic Madelung equations actually kind of fell aside. But there were people like Bloch and others that tried to extend the Madelung equations to the many-body case. But they couldn't do it until field theory was invented. And so it took quite a long time until Martin and Schwinger, in their famous FISRAV 1959, right? They showed that the many-body time-dependent Schrödinger equation can be written exactly without any approximation in a hydrodynamic form. By hydrodynamic here, I mean really a description in terms of collective variables like the density and the current, the velocity field, which is the current density by the density. The first equation is the continuity, right? And the second equation is essentially the second law of dynamics. There is no approximation here. In fact, so this is an external potential. This is the derivative, essentially, of the velocity field. And this is what where all the information on electron-electron interactions are included. This is the famous stress tensor, which in hydrodynamics, we usually use the Navier-Stokes. But here, we don't know what it is, because if we knew it, we would have solved, in fact, the many-body time-dependent Schrödinger equation. Now, to go backward from, so you know that going from the many-body Schrödinger equation down to the hydrodynamic equation, it was proven by Martin Schwinger. To go back, you have to wait until the theorems of time-dependent density functional theory that tell you, and time-dependent current density functional theory that tell you that given a density, right, or better, there is a one-to-one correspondence between density and scalar potentials, or one-to-one correspondence between current density and vector potentials. But this is exact, okay? In fact, if you look at it, a hydrodynamic formulation is much more natural in quantum mechanics than in classical physics. In classical physics, you have to take your liquid, divide it into small volumes, large enough that you have enough particles that you define, right, a continuum, and then you build it. But in quantum mechanics, it's natural because the wave function is continuous by definition. Okay, well, then look at this. There is a very fast relaxation, right, in systems of nanoscale systems, right? And I would like to solve this, but I don't know the stress tensor. So how do I actually solve that equation? Well, if I try to solve it, so I try to look for an equation of motion for the two-particle stress tensor, you end up with an equation of motion that contains also the three-particle stress tensor. Well, then I need an equation of motion for the three-particle stress tensor. Well, if you do the math, then you would get an equation of motion that contains also the four-particle stress tensor. You would have the famous BBGKY hierarchy. So it's unsolvable. In fact, I give you here the first equation. The collision integral is I here, and you see that you have, in fact, the gradient of the three-particle stress tensor here and the two-particle stress tensor. So I cannot close this equation. But if I have actually a very fast momentum relaxation, as I showed you before, then this term actually can be neglected. It's very small. It's like saying that two particles see each other very fast, but the third particle will not see those two particles interacting. In fact, this is true also if the density of the liquid is very small, because this is a condition on the gradient, not on the absolute value. So if you do actually do this approximation, you can close this set of equations, and what you end up is with a stress tensor is very similar to the Navier-Stokes classical stress tensor, with the only difference that the viscosity is h bar times a function of the density. So h bar enters in this in the effective viscosity of this stress tensor. So in nanoscale systems, the analogy with electron with a classical liquid can be pushed even further, because I can compute. I can close the set of equations of motion, which are exact in general, but I cannot compute, and I would have a set of equations which look like classical hydrodynamic equations, Landau-Lifshitz type, right, Navier-Stokes, where I have a pressure term and a viscosity that contains h-bar, and the pressure also will contain h-bar, right, due to Fermi statistics. So, the first thing that comes to mind is, can I reproduce known results from hydrodynamics? For example, I know that in a 1D, in a stationary non-viscous fluid, I have to have a quantized conductance. Well, you do. In fact, from these Navier-Stokes equations, you get the Bernoulli equation, and if you solve it, you will actually end up with the current versus voltage with a proportionality, which is E squared over H, which is the quantized conductance. So this allows me to interpret the quantized conductance as the one of an ideal means non-viscous 1D charged liquid, fluid. So this is interesting, because you can actually get the quantized conductance from essentially classical hydrodynamics, where the pressure is given here, the enthalpy is given here, H bar you see is here. And then the next question is, well, if I do have a description that is like a hydrodynamic description, then I must have, under certain conditions, a turbulence of the electron liquid, right? Like I have it in classical physics. In fact, the idea to go into the hydrodynamics was because I was looking for an effective theory to describe heating, electron heating. Electrons, when they go into a nanostructure like this, they would heat up. They will increase their local temperature. And try to do this using the many-body time-dependence equation. It's a mess, right? In an effective hydrodynamic picture, it's much easier because you have an equation of motion for the temperature. I will not talk about this that because it would take me longer. By the way, it was verified, that prediction. So they actually observed the effect of the electron heating on the ionic heating. And in fact, it comes out very reasonable. I mean, the predictions also numerically are reasonable. But let me talk about the turbulence. So suppose I have a structure like this. This is, let's say, an atomic quantum point contact. An approximate potential for the electrons is like this. It's like an adiabatic pipe, right? But if I had a molecule like this between the electrodes, then this would be highly non-adiabatic. So which of the two you think will give you turbulence? Well, we know from classical physics, right, that adiabatic flow, actually something like this, leads to Poiseuille flow, right? And Poiseuille flow is essentially a laminar up to Reynolds numbers that are huge. In fact, what I can do here is define a Reynolds number. I would call it a quantum between quotes, where quantum comes from the viscosity of the electron liquid. And the viscosity of the electron liquid, by the way, is very small, okay? So you have a very, very small viscosity, very fast particles, right? And you know that the smaller the viscosity, the easier it is to generate turbulence. And so, but in this case, if you plug in the numbers in a Poiseuille flow, you will need currents that are enormous. No system that I know of would sustain that amount of current and generate turbulence in a Poiseuille flow. But a structure like this would show turbulence, and in fact, it will show a transition between the laminar regime and the turbulent regime. And the transition of the Reynolds number depends on the geometry, right? If I open the, it's like a pipe, right? The electrons arrive here and they see an opening of an angle beta. The more open, right, that is, and easier it is to generate turbulence, like when you actually use a, you know, a hose, you see it. So the same thing here. In fact, if you put numbers here, the interesting thing is that you can get this using the 2D electron gas. In fact, recently people are thinking and have observed, at least numerically, of this in graphene. So people are thinking about turbulence in graphene nanostructures. So let me show you some results. In fact, how do you measure this thing once you have it? Then. Here is the essentially solving the Schrödinger equation, right, in time. And this is the effective Navier-Stokes equations with the same initial conditions, the same viscosity as this. And a very small biases, you have current from here to here, and the voltages increase like this. You see the flow is essentially laminar. But look at this, at 3 volts, by the way, the voltage is high because we're talking about gold, density of gold. You start to have eddies. And so if I look at this actually in other situations like this, you have eddies that form right after the obstacle, similar to what you have in classical physics, where you have eddies that form behind the obstacle. And in fact, if I look at, I do a simulation of this with the parameters of the electron liquid with gold as the density, after a transient, a very small bias, this is a very small bias, everything is laminar. This is electrons go from here to here through a nanojunction. Okay, nothing changes. But if I actually do it in the for a larger bias, then you start to have eddies, and after a while you break also the left-right symmetry, and you would have turbulence also developing in this system. So the question is, how do I measure it? Okay, this is a nice prediction, but you have to tell me also how I measure it. Okay. Well, if yes.
Mm-hmm. So the momentum is not really a good quantum number.
That's correct.
So
also in this case, it's not a good quantum number.
But this, when you draw a picture, it looks as though the it's smooth on a microscopic scale.
That's right. Then I'll tell you how, in fact, I measure it, right?
But in real life, there's going to be impurities. It's mess up momentum constraints.
That's correct. In fact, what you would see, in fact, if you look at the you know, the results by Westerveld, for example, right, where they actually see the reflection of waves and they see interference, right, with the defects at the origin, they could have actually turbulence. In fact, I asked them to look more in detail. It is superimposed to any other type of disorder that you would see. In fact, you have all sorts of eddies, right, that form. If I have a strong disorder, the eddies would be very localized close to the disorder. If the disorder is spread, you can have eddies in between large enough that you could detect. So the predictions that we're making assume that you can have, let's say, the scattering length with the defects long enough that the eddies are not localized narrowly around the defects, but they can spread, okay? So you would see these type of things. If you have a disorder, it's even better, right, to generate a turbulence. The question is, how big are the eddies? If they are too small, you're not gonna see them, right? In fact, after I saw saw these things, it's probably occurring all the time. Turbulence is probably occurring also at the surface of systems. Why we don't detect it? Well, to detect directly turbulence, you need to detect directly the current density, because the average current is weakly perturbed by turbulence. In fact, the viscosity is so small that it doesn't affect almost anything, right, in terms of the magnitude of the total current. The current density is what you should look for. So we were looking, in fact, at the things where you can monitor the current density. How do you do it? So one way is to put squids. If I have a 2-deg and I put the squids, one on top and one on the bottom, or you can use a squid mounted on an STM, right, a movable squid, like what Moeller does at Stanford, right? And what you should see, in fact, if you look at the, so these are data that, in fact, that we took with the, I mean, results, numerical results with the realistic parameters now, okay? So the squids are positioned at a distance that is visible experimentally. So you will detect the magnetic fields. So in the lamina regime, right, there is not much of a difference in the magnetic field. But when you start having eddies, you would have magnetic fields that are stronger here than here, right? So you would, you should see a difference. So if I have a very low current or very low bias lamina regime, and I plot the ratio between these two, it's essentially one. There shouldn't be any change in flux of the squid above and below, right? But if I do actually increase the current, all of a sudden I start to generate eddies, right? And actually I can generate eddies of the opposite side. And in fact, at a certain point, the turbulence can become so strong that I generate eddies rotating in the opposite side, and so reducing the flux in here. And so you would see this transition. And if you look at the numbers, they're reasonable. In fact, I suggested to Westerveld and Moeller to do these experiments, and they never did. In fact, I suggested them, this was in 2007, to do it on graphene. And you know, a few years later, somebody actually showed that in graphene you can have similar turbulent behavior. Theoretically, okay, not experimentally, theoretically. Okay, so let me then, I think I don't have much time. Let me go back and see whether I can actually quantify this this viscosity of the electron liquid in a much more rigorous way. And so I do it in linear response theory, and I look at a usual mesoscopic situation where I have several currents, right? And I look at the conductances across the different wires. Then I can do perturbation theory, and in fact, the first diagram would give me the Landauer formula, and all the others are the corrections to that, right? Now, I can actually look at this. So this is the Landauer formula, comes effectively from the first diagram of the current response. So what I can actually do using time-dependent current density functional theory is, in fact, to write down the electric field that acts on the system as an electric field that interacts with non-interacting systems, and then an electric field that contains all the effects of exchange and correlation. And if I do this, in fact, I can show that I can split the resistivity or the conductivity as a non-interacting part and everything else that contains exchange correlation contributions. In fact, what you can show in a time-dependent current densifactorial theory is that this field, I won't go into the details, this field, the exchange correlation field, has essentially a pressure term, an adiabatic LDA called the pressure term, and then a stress tensor that is similar to a Navier-Stokes stress tensor. So I can recover essentially the same form that I recovered before using time-dependent current density functional theory. In fact, this allows me also to compute some of these coefficients, right, like the bulk viscosity and the shear viscosity. And what we can actually check is what is the magnitude. I go back to the issue of magnitude. What is the effect of the viscosity on the magnitude of the current? Well, that depends on how different is the density between the bulk electrodes and the nanostructure. So if I have a nanostructure where the density doesn't vary much, like a quantum point contact, then the variation of the density is very small, and the resistance due to this extra resistance due to viscosity is very small. We actually computed a formula that shows what is the effect of this resistance coming from the viscosity. But if I have a very large change in density, then I would get a larger change in resistance. So these many body effects actually do contribute more if I have structures where the liquid has to change abruptly. And it makes sense, right? Because if I have a liquid that has to change momentum very rapidly, that's when you would have a lot of resistance coming from many body effects. Instead, a system where it flows very smoothly doesn't affect much. You know, it doesn't feel much, right, the many-body effect. Okay, I won't go into this because I wanted to, actually, the last few minutes, I wanted to discuss how do you prove some of these things in atomic physics. The only point I wanted to make is that we actually, if I look at the viscosity, right, there is the viscosity is the big unknown. In fact, you know from the bulk from Abrikosov-Kolatnikov theory of homogeneous electron liquid, you know that the viscosity diverges, right, at zero frequency, at zero temperature. So you would have this divergence. And then at a very high frequency, it actually reaches essentially a plateau. Now, if I have a structure in between, this breaks a symmetry, right? So I'm not here and I'm not here. I'm somewhere here. So the nanostructure or an object in the middle of the electron liquid acts like a temperature, like an effective cutoff of the divergence of the viscosity. In fact, we computed this as a function of the transmission, but I won't go into that. We also compare with the bulk result, which is known in literature, and we found very good results. I want to go to actually the last thing, and the properties of steady states and predictions and how we actually can prove them with the atomic gases. So I go back to this picture, as I told you. In fact, the microcanonical picture of transport is ideal for these atomic gases because they are essentially isolated systems. And this tells us also is that the formation of a steady state has nothing to do with whether you have an infinite set of electrodes or not, right? Because if I have, the steady state, the quasi-steady state forms very fast, and then it stays there. Clearly, if I want to maintain it, I need to make the electrodes longer and longer, right? That's what the battery would do. It would essentially recharge it so the discharge continues. But the existence of a steady state has nothing to do with the infinite nature of the electrodes. Not only that, it has nothing to do with the existence or not of interactions. This is a non-interacting system. So I can actually reach a steady state even in the absence of interactions. So how do I show this experimentally? Well, cold atoms are ideal for this because you can put both fermions and bosons in there. You can put them, harmonic traps, optical lattices, and so forth. You can have multiple species, several dimensions, so from 3D to 1D, and so forth. And you can actually, that's the nice thing about cold gases, you can tune the interactions. In condensed matter, if you want to prove that a steady state is formed even without interactions, I'm not aware of an easy way to do it. But in gases, right, atomic gases, it can literally switch off the interactions. And so, and this is just a sample of experiments that can be done. In fact, they can now do a lot of things like locally perturbing the interactions. So if you do this, yes?
So the steady state depends on the initial state of the system.
That's correct. That's correct. Yeah, I don't have time to discuss that, but that is another interesting point. It depends on the initial state. And what we actually find is that you can have the same macroscopic steady state current with many initial states. So you can have a macroscopic quantity, an observable, right, that is realized by many initial states. The question is which one is selected by nature, right?
But in principle, it's not like a thermal state.
No, in principle, it's not a thermal state. Not in, in fact, I don't see a reason why it should be always a thermal state. Yeah. In fact, it's not. But there is an interesting point, right? So if I have a steady state, how many microscopic states realize such a steady state? That is another interesting point. So actually, we can do, we did this simulations, and as you can see, in the fermion case, again, you would see steady states as a function of the filling. This is for fermions. The interesting thing is that if you try to do this for bosons, at least without interactions and without temperature, they will not reach a steady state, a finite current. And we did also analytically this, and we find that the current goes to zero for the bosons as n to the minus 1/2. N is the lattice size. And in fact, the reason why they don't reach a steady state, unlike the fermions, is that the bosons see each other at infinity, essentially, right? The correlations are spatially everywhere. While for fermions, essentially, they can somehow see themselves as separate, okay? So this is the intuitive way of seeing this. By the way, you can actually show that these steady states survive with finite temperature or with the traps, right? The harmonic traps. So they should be very robust. And in fact, if you look at the numbers, the experimentalists that do atomic physics, they should be able to see it very, very clearly. And in fact, they could actually answer the question also whether you have the same current starting from different steady states. That, in fact, is an interesting problem because without interactions, you probably end up always in the same steady state. With interactions, you may end up into several steady states according to the initial conditions. It's it's an open question, but it's probably also, yeah. It could be. For some observables, yes, it could be. And the other, one of the last things I wanted to talk about is you can actually induce a current in atomic gases by switching on interactions in parts of the system, and that has been shown. In fact, you can actually switch on interactions only in parts of the system, something you cannot do in condensed matter physics. And so one of the predictions we made is, suppose I have a lattice filled with atoms, right, and I switch just half of the lattice with the interactions, and we computed at both at a mean field level and then adding some correlations, and the results don't change. What you see is an interesting thing. Essentially, you see a negative differential resistance. When I switch the interactions, increasing the interactions, at first the current increases and then drops. It's like a negative differential resistance that you have in condensed matter physics. And the reason is the same. As soon as if I look at the distribution of charges on the left and on the right, when I have the two bands that don't see each other, then there is no conservation of energy, right? So I cannot actually go on the other side from left to right. So when the energy on the left is too high compared to the energy on the right, then I would have this blockade type of effect. So this is another prediction that would be interesting to look at. I think my time is up, so I'll just conclude. So I showed you that the Landauer picture, the famous Landauer picture, is incomplete. In fact, it's an incomplete description of transport. And what I showed you is, in fact, that there are several things that are not included in there, like viscosity effects, which lead to interesting phenomena. One of them is the turbulence, which, again, would be nice to verify, at least. One way we suggest is using squids. The other way is optically, right, verifying optically this thing. But the other interesting things would be the formation of steady states. And this can be verified in atomic lattices, because in condensed matter physics, you cannot really, monitor or better modify locally interactions, number of particles, and so forth. And what I have shown is that the quasi-steady states form irrespective of the Fermi distributions and very fast. And also I showed you, a transition from conducting, non-conducting transition due to interactions, which has nothing to do with Mott transition, by the way, okay? It's a dynamical transition. Okay, so I think I stop here. And thank you very much for your attention. I'll take any question. Yes?
So I think a lot of your theory, based on the assumption of this Michael canonical picture of the
transport. Say this again?
Michael canonical transport.
Yes.
Picture of transport.
Yes.
Right? So, I mean, I'm just shooting you with the answer question. So when do you think this picture will break down like that underwards?
In principle, the microcanonical picture of transport is solving essentially the exact many-body problem, right? So it doesn't break down unless you have things like interaction with an environment, right? Then you would have to go beyond the microcanonical description, and in that case, the fact has to be taken into account. You could do it by taking into account also the environment to trace out the environment degrees of freedom, but you know that it's not an easy thing to do. So in reality, it doesn't break down because it is essentially the solution of the many-body time-dependent Schrödinger equation with an initial condition, and you let the system evolve, right? So that is, it's in fact, it goes back, if you wish, to a much more rigorous way of treating transport rather than the Landauer approach, which makes tons of approximations.
Yeah, I imagine some new feature here would appear kind of like in the far from equilibrium situation.
Mm-hmm.
So usually, how to achieve that? I don't have much idea. You know, in some kind of typical setup like a macroscopic device, how do you achieve this far from equilibrium situation? Whether you apply large currents or
Either way, you can do either way.
How many volts?
Well, I mean that depends on the structure. So for structures like atomic quantum point contacts, you can reach volts of on the order of 1 volt. Beyond that, you break it. It's not obvious whether you break it because of current-induced forces, what breaks these things, right? Our computers, or heating. That is still an open question. But they can generally reach 1 volt or even more, according to the...
In that case, do you see this kind of far from equilibrium phenomena?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, these are essentially out of equilibrium, far from equilibrium. If I have, however, I wanted to finish that. If I have molecules, they actually they claim they can go even higher, but it depends on the molecule and the system. So it depends on the system, but it 1 volt is not a small thing. And if you transform it into amps, right? If I could drive nanoamps or microamps in the system, that's a huge current for this type of systems. Yes.
So. You have this tower of equations of two-body tensor and three-body tensor.
You
sort of close the equation by neglecting the three-body tensor.
Right. So you
have some physical argument why you. Can
that's right.
That aside.
You cannot neglect that by taking a if there is a fast relaxation mechanism or the density of the liquid is very small. Either way.
So I would imagine you can also close the equation if you only consider two and three body.
That's correct, but it would be much more complicated. Because
you haven't checked.
No.
Because
if you go beyond if you go beyond the third, right, you include the fourth, you won't have an Navier-Stokes type of equation, right?
I see.
So, so in order to have a Navier-Stokes type, you have to close it at the second order.
Okay, so that's where you can use the equation
right.
coming from.
That's right. Clearly, if that approximation is not valid under certain conditions, for example, you know, the momentum relaxation is not fast enough, then you cannot take. In fact, honestly, I think in bulk or mesoscopic systems, even if I have a constriction in a mesoscopic system, probably doesn't apply because there are other scattering mechanisms that come into play, like inelastic electron foam interactions, you know, before even this fast momentum relaxation occurs. So you need to be under those conditions to see turbulence. But if I have a surface with defects, right, you know, turbulence is localized around the defects. So in that case, you have a very fast relaxation of momentum, so you probably can use the same equations. Yes?
Do you have any notion of entropy production in this formation?
Yeah, we I estimated the entanglement entropy, right? Yeah, we that for non-interacting, we did estimate that.
But if,
oops,
I mean, I was thinking more of the, so since again we are in a non-equilibrium, far from equilibrium situations, so normally this, I have in mind a picture where you have a system and an environment.
Mm-hmm.
So if, for example, you have a difference in chemical potential between the two leads, the system would, so the entropy production that is given by the interaction from the system and the environment would be given by some property of the state of the system and then the amount of particle exchange between
That's right.
the system and environment. But here it's not clear to me
no, here,
that the system is closed.
Right. Here the only thing you can define is the entanglement entropy of one part versus the other. And when, if you do this, I don't know if I have the figures of this. Probably not. Oh, here it is. You see, it's essentially you see this type of behavior of the of this entanglement entropy. It's essentially flat, sorry, linear with time. So, in fact, if you extrapolate from here the rate, then for non-interacting systems, then you get a very good agreement. Where is it? This thing. Very good agreement with the formula you would get assuming binomial distribution. See what I'm saying? So the fact that the system is closed doesn't mean that you can never define a part where I have, you know, it's like a reservoir, if you wish, right? A big reservoir of particles that flow on one side. So that is what this would indicate. Because the formula that underlies these continuous curves assumes reservoirs that throw particles at random, right, with a well-defined probability distribution. We don't have that. And despite that, we do actually find the same result. So overall, the entanglement entropy of this closed system mimics this phenomenon, you see, of particles coming in, partly reflecting, partly transmitting.
More questions?
Yeah.
Let's thank Massimiliano again.
Thank you.